impeachment proceedings. The first time in history a president will be impeached twice. On our website, democracynow.org, we'll be streaming the full debate and vote starting at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Carla Wills, Tommy Waranoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Adriano Contreras. Our general manager, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Bernard, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Have you gotten your flu shot? It's never too late to protect yourself, your family, and your community against the flu. This year, it is more important than ever. Black and African Americans, people of color, pregnant people, people without health insurance or a regular health care provider, people with pre-existing conditions like asthma, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, and people 65 and older are encouraged to get a flu shot. Multnomah County Health Department and Portland Community College are hosting a free weekly drive-through flu vaccine and COVID-19 testing clinic that will be held every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. until March 31, 2021, at PCC's Cascade Campus, Parking Lot 1, located at 701 North Jessup Street in Portland. Entrance is on North Albina Street. You can drive through, bike through, or walk up to. To reserve an appointment for a flu shot or COVID test, call 503-988-8939. That's 503-988-8939. This campaign is a project of the Racial and Ethnic Approaches to Community Health and the Communicable Disease Services programs. It is made possible with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Public Service Announcements.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8:01. It's second Wednesday. Coming up, the Wednesday Talk Radio program with your hosts, Paul Rowland and Jacqueline Keeler. Stay tuned.
Hold your head up, lift the top of your mind, put your eyes on the earth, lift your heart.
And good morning, everybody. This is your regular host, Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio, and I do have my second Wednesday co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, who is of Navajo and Dakota lineage and is a local activist and writer and the author of a soon-to-be-out-in-paperback, March 30th, a book, which relates directly to what we'll be talking about today, Standoff, Standing Rock, the Bundy Movement, and the American story of Sacred Lands, as I said, coming out very soon, already out on Kindle. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning.
So I first wanted to just let all our listeners know that last week I just had to take a break from my own, mental and emotional health, just, I guess, feeling a little overwhelmed by things. And little did I know that the very same day, all hell would break out in our nation's capital. And, gosh, I kind of wish I could have been talking all about what was going to happen and predicted it. But I didn't. But now we are going to talk about it. And before I do that, I do want to once again refer to my interview of a couple months ago with Ted Rall, the political cartoonist, graphic novelist, writer, who did, in a lot of ways, actually predict what happened on Wednesday. And I'll have to admit, I kind of want to start out our conversation, Jackie, by admitting that I didn't give enough credence to what he was talking about. And, I had one listener write in and say it was the lunatic fringe, kind of the equivalent of QAnon. And I imagine a lot of listeners didn't really hear the dire warning of actual possible coup attempt that he outlined. Not in his details, the timing wasn't exactly right, but a lot of the elements that he laid out were right there. So I don't know, hats off to Ted Rall. You can go to I think it's tedrall.com. It's RALL, and he talks about what happened on Wednesday, and he's one of the few voices that I came across that actually laid it out. But as we're going to talk about, Jackie, you certainly saw something like this coming in your analysis of United States history and the violent colonization and the continuing colonization, especially in the West, and the Bundy occupation. And in fact, Clive and Bundy just lent his public support to what happened on Wednesday. So I don't know, what were your first impressions of what happened a week ago?
Yeah, well, I mean, I knew this was coming, and my book, I wrote an entire book about it coming, because what stand off by examining, I should say that I'm a citizen of the Navajo Nation, and my father is a citizen of the Yankton Sioux tribe, and I'm not of descent. I'm actually a citizen of the Navajo Nation. And I wrote the book because I wanted to understand, after seeing what happened. You know, a lot of us now in January 2021 are just completely shocked by what happened in the Capitol here. But you know, when it happened here in Oregon in January 2016, I had many of the same concerns and feelings, because as a Native woman, you know, white men with guns means only one thing, and it means that they're asserting their colonial rights, which they are very confident the colonial government supports. And so I began January 2016 covering the Malheur occupation from the perspective of the Burns Paiute tribe. And I covered this primarily for Indian Country Day, but also for Telesur and another outlet. I was interviewed on Democracy Now! By Amy Goodman. And then I ended the year 2016 at Standing Rock in the snow. I started in the snow, and I ended in the snow. And it's just, you know, it's these two armed takeovers in the snow in 2016. You know, they it really struck me that this was sort of, with comparing these two standoffs, would be a very constructive way to be able to understand what the polarization in this country is all about, by looking at the historical, philosophical roots of each standoff. And so with the Bundys, I, of course, the focus had to be on the Bundy family and their ideology, which, you know, they had a book. I mean, they have this sort of a collection of sayings and quotations from both the Revolutionary War, the Constitution, the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants of the LDS Church. And then they also had, they had this book of philosophical philosophy and his history. And so I really began examining the language they were using. And of course, a lot of it comes out of the Revolutionary War. And then before that, the English Civil War. And so I really began examining what these things that were coming out of their mouths, what they were referencing, what they meant, and looking at the history and giving it a context that is more useful to us. Because the framework we are taught about the Revolutionary War is what I've realized is a lot of it is propaganda. It's not really history, because it doesn't give us the tools to understand what the motivations of the Founding Fathers were, who, as many of your listeners know, were slave owners, were slavers, right? Even Hamilton, they all have most of them. I mean, I think someone did this really great thing where they put a red dot over every single founding father, every who was signing the Declaration of Independence, in that painting, and almost all of them have red dots on their faces. Just a few don't, right? But even in the North, there was a lot of connection with the Golden Triangle, the slave trade. You know, a lot of those northern cities like Boston, even up to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and certainly Providence, Rhode Island, and Baltimore were heavily involved in the slave trade. So I began to look at the actual reasons for the Revolutionary War, and particularly the quest for land. All of these founding fathers, all of them were invested in land companies. George Washington was invested in the Ohio Land Company, and a lot of the roots of the Revolutionary War go back to the French and Indian War and the settlement of that war. And it's interesting because what I discovered during the research was that that George Washington himself, as a young man, he was like 20, 21 years old, he actually started the First World War. The French and Indian War in Europe is called the Seven Years' War, and historians call it World War Zero. And it's the first war where, sort of this world war. And so he, as a young man, was sent by Virginia with a militia, and he went up there and he tried to assert in the Ohio Valley Virginia's claims to the Ohio Valley, which they had under their charter, and with the British Crown. And so they, so he went with a group of men, and he, had a diplomatic mishap where he and his forces killed the French diplomat, and then he was overwhelmed at Fort Necessity, I think it was called, and he actually had to sign a letter in French, which he could not read, admitting guilt to the murder of this French diplomat, which sparked the World War. And so, in a sense, the whole phrase of taxation without representation is incorrect, because the colonists started the war, and they were the only ones who were really going to benefit from it with access to Indian lands, which they had been forbidden to do. And so, they started a war that doubled the national debt of both Britain and France. And so, yes, they were asked to pay for it. This is what the taxes were for. This is what the quartering was for. And a lot of the stuff you see in the Declaration of Independence are complaints about the settlement and of the French and Indian War, because part of the treaty that was signed required King George III to prevent the colonists from crossing the Appalachian Mountains. You have to realize that the 13 colonies only extended along the coast, along the seaboard there, and they did not cross over. Everything west of the Appalachians was Indian land, particularly New York State, which was, of course, upstate New York was of course the Iroquois Confederacy. It had been the Iroquois Confederacy for 1,000 years. My husband's direct ancestor, Chief Joseph Brant, led the fight against the colonists to preserve the Confederacy. And of course the Ohio Valley and everything west of it was instrumental in the Trail of Tears and pushing out the Cherokees and all these tribes in the Deep South and Georgia. A lot of the areas in Georgia that are depicted in, heinous films like Gone with the Wind, were only recently occupied by the white settlers. They were actually Indian territory until like 30 years before. And so it was, the history of the taking of the land. And this is what they're discussing. And this is why these people feel so emboldened, because they were promised certain things, and as colonists, they are exerting those promises, and they definitely view this government as their government. And the rest of us who suddenly have the vote, brown and black, and indigenous, people of color, we are not regarded as legitimately part of this country, and certainly shouldn't have the right to make determinations that are counter to theirs. I mean, 73 million Americans voted for Trump, you know, and so it's, you know, 80 million voted for Biden, but it's still a very substantial number of people. And from the polls I'm seeing, you know, almost half of all Republicans still feel the, even after what happened at the Capitol building, you know, the deadly insurrection there, that that Biden is not really the president, you know. So it's, go ahead.
Well, before we get further into what you're talking about, I just, something really struck me with what you were just saying about the history, which is that, would you say that in some ways you could draw a parallel between, you know, the grievances of Germany after World War One, which led to World War Two, and how, as you say, World War Zero, and the huge debt, and the grievances of the colonists directly led to the Revolutionary War? It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, and you know, when you look at the origins of democracy here in the United States, and many people point to, of course, the Iroquois Confederacy. You know, Congress made a resolution honoring the Iroquois Confederacy's influence on the creation of the United States of America as a political entity. But also, it was based on the Iroquois Confederacy. And but the but you know, you look at Jeffersonian democracy, and you look at this concept of a yeoman farmer voter, right, where this will be a country full of yeoman farmers. Well, how do these, you know, huge colonial families, you know, I know that people often say, oh, you know, these women had 12 kids, but only four lived to adulthood. I've been doing genealogies of fake Indians, and what I noticed is that these families don't die off. The 12 kids live, and they each want a farm, do you know what I mean? And so this is what, this was like a, I often compare it to, in Dakota, we have a monster called the Iya, who, it's this monster that goes around and eats tribes up, right? And at night, you can see the tribes, their campfires inside the monster glowing. And you know, you have that, there's a whole story, a hero story about freeing those tribes from the monster. And this is what happened to our nations across this continent as these colonists traveled across, needing farms so they could be yeoman farmer voters, right? And so this kind of democracy is in one way revolutionary because the yeoman farmer did not exist in Europe, because most of the land was owned, you know, it's still to this day owned by the beneficiaries of the feudal system, right? I think in England, more than half the land is still owned by the people who invaded with William the Conqueror, and in Scotland, it's even higher, 3/4 of the land is still owned by, you know, these old gentry families. You know, it's you know, this is a system wherein most people do not own land. You know, even if you were to buy a house in London, the land would still be owned by the English, you know, nobility that owned the land, but because they own sections of London, but you would have a freehold, so you own the building but you don't own the land. It's more of a long-term lease. So land ownership is a revolutionary concept that Jefferson was talking about at the time. But it was only possible through the taking of land of Indian people. And so this whole concept of voting and democracy that we have, it comes out of a history of really straight-up colonialism. And this is why people why the rural vote really, you know, feel that they have rights. They have these rights that supersede ours.
This is KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio, and I'm the regular host, Paul Rowland, and I have also on the phone my second Wednesday co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, who, as she said, is a citizen of the Navajo Nation, and her father hails from the Dakota Nation. And we're talking about the events at the Capitol, which is, of course, foremost on everybody's mind. We're all, I think, a bit rattled, even those of us who saw it coming in one way or another. I certainly didn't see the incredible force of it, and there's so many aspects of it to the, you know, the people taking, so the sort of the combination of the people really going berserk, actually having planned it out pretty thoroughly, as people are starting to see. Amy Goodman was talking about this morning with Juan Gonzalez and her guest Timothy Snyder, the a historian of fascism, that there's elements of police, elements of military, that there's these QAnon conspiracists, but there's also sort of a casualness of it, that people, you know, the entitlement that the idea, I mean, part of it, I guess, was sort of this mass delusion. A lot of people just sort of had worked themselves up into this delusionary sense that they had been wronged by this theft of the election. But in combination with this total entitlement, white entitlement. Anyway, so we're talking about that. We're talking about the line that can be drawn from the history that Jacqueline is talking about through the continual imposition of white supremacy and continual theft of Indian lands, and through the termination period, and through the Bundy occupation, and to the attempted coup at the Capitol. One thing that I just wanted to get this out that struck me in the CNN coverage, one person said that they interviewed, I don't know if anybody else caught this, they're interviewing these people about why they're there. One person said, "This is our Capitol, we built it," which just struck me as incredibly telling that obviously, actually, the Capitol was built with slave labor.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Yeah, I'd have to say, you know, it does, when I hear journalists, particularly white journalists, going on about, our history in this lovely building and democracy, I think this building has a very complicated history. Not all of it, some of it is really quite heinous, do you know what I mean? As is the history of this country, and is the history of the democracy in this country. And I think that, our white journalists, white people should be a lot more cognizant of that, even when they're reporting on this issue. And to hear, Biden say that, this is not America, I think that, I understand his position of having to sort of, appease, all these white people. But at the same time, I think that we need more honesty. We need to say, this is America. This is exactly what America is about, and what's happening now is you have Stacey Abrams, the black woman who is a former candidate for governor of Georgia, who was cheated out of that position by the present governor of Georgia, who is a secretary of state controlling the voting, a white guy. But she went in and she fought for the black vote. She made sure that black voters turned out, which the Democratic Party has really failed to do. They've been chasing after the mythical white swing voter, that unicorn, they have really, abandoned black voters and other other people of color voters. They have not protected our vote. I don't think that they really regard us as part of their party. And so you have women of color, particularly in the Democratic Party, from the squad with AOC and Stacey Abrams, and they're taking the reins. They're fighting for us. And so she won them control of the Senate through her work. She gave up her own political career in order to make that happen. And this is the response. Black excellence and black joy is met with white rage in the Capitol, and a deadly white rage. People died, and you see, the black folks working in the White House or in the Capitol building cleaning up the mess afterwards, or black police being faced with these white intruders. And it's just, but the folks who conducted this are in no way, they don't feel guilty. They feel they really believe everything that they've been, that they're, this is why I say white people can't fix this problem. The problem is that white people live, as I've said on your show before, live in the house that white supremacy built. And they have a lot of blind spots because they can only see, the view that is framed by the window of that house, or they walk through that house and they think that house is in the entire world, so they lack the ability to really assess the situation and understand what needs to be done. And they, they're very drawn to each other. They don't really want to deal with us, the rest of us, right? And this is going to be more and more of a problem as you know, white people become the minority. And you know, and whiteness being the majority, that was a specific policy by the United States. You know, immigration laws, you know, land, you know, the giving of land, you know, homesteading, everything was preference to white people. And you know, in fact, you know, I think with the Northwest ordinance, or you know, basically says that if you have so many white men in a territory, that you can apply for statehood, right? You know, white voters, white male voters. It, the whole thing is set up in a certain way, and now that is being upended, and for very good reasons, because that was, you know, an incredibly unfair and horrific system, particularly with slavery. You know, I think America needs to rethink itself, honestly. You know, they can't patch over the history and build this great sort of narrative. And as I've said before on the show, that, you know, what Standoff also addresses is the story of the Lakota and Dakota people, the Ocheti Shakoan, what the United States calls the Great Sioux Nation, right? And other indigenous nations. These are our homelands. These are not your homelands. You're a colonist, you know, and Americans need to get their head around the fact that they are actively still colonizing. You know, what Standing Rock showed was this is an ongoing occupation of our homeland. That land north of Standing Rock Sea Reservation, where the pipeline was going across, even the crossing of the river, is we signed a treaty that was ratified by the U.S. Senate. You know, the Senate only ratifies treaties with other sovereign nations. This is international law. It is also under the Constitution, the highest law of the land, the treaties are. And so, you know, all that is unceded treaty territory. The U.S. government agreed to honor our rights to that area. And it's about the size of Great Britain under this one treaty, the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868. And it's, you know, I think, you know, and so, you know, we need to sit down at the table. And if Americans really are who they say they are, they will sit down with us and they will renegotiate the terms of our relationship. It cannot be a relationship of colonizer emboldened by these ridiculous ideas of themselves and propaganda versus everyone else. You know, if you are a good person and you're listening to the show and you consider yourself a moral person, you really have to ask yourself, what does ethical colonialism look like? Because you are a colonist, and that's the only thing you could possibly hope for. You know, and so it's so we need to rewrite that relationship. This whole thing is going to break otherwise. I mean, these people are not going to stand down. I know. I really recommend listening to the second season of Bundy, though. Leah Sotil, who is a reporter, covered the Bundys, and you know, the second season of her podcast really goes into just how deeply seated the armed white militias are here in the Pacific Northwest, you know, going back to the 1970s and in, you know, north of Spokane in Idaho, and it's, you know, Spokane, Washington, northern Idaho, you know, it's, she goes into the whole history of it, and it's, you know, these people have long, this has long roots. Of course, the Bundys, you're looking, going back to the Sagebrush Rebellion in the 1970s, which was abetted and aided by Reagan once he got into power. You know, and of course, with the Trump administration, you know, they actually began the process of moving the Bureau of Land Management, you know, their offices from Washington, D.C. to local communities, local rural communities, because they wanted them there so that they would be more accountable to the white rural population and they could intimidate them, just like they're intimidating folks now, you know, and the way they intimidated you know, the you know, folks in Harney County, you know, the sheriff there, his wife had to leave town and hide somewhere with her children because she was being, they had their tires slashed at their home, you know, and all the Fish and Wildlife Service folks had to be relocated because they were fearing for their lives. So this act of intimidation, of terrorism, this is a long-term tactic in history in this country. You know, you can look at the history of lynching, of all of these things, of terrorizing the rest of us into submission. And so, yeah, I think it's, you know, but I would really recommend that. And very clear. Yeah.
What's the name of the podcast again?
Bundyville.
Bundyville. Okay. And I'll try to add that into my program page at KBO.FM Wednesday Talk Radio. You are listening to KBO Community Radio. This is the Wednesday version of the talk show strip every morning from 8 until 9 a.m. I'm your regular host, Paul Rowland. I have with me my second Wednesday co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, and we're doing a deep dive into the roots of what is happening. I was struck by something that the guest on Democracy Now, historian of fascism, Tim Snyder, said, that, you know, calling for a blue ribbon commission to thoroughly study, you know, who let who in. You know, there's now accusations that AOC was saying that that actually Republican lawmakers were actually giving reconnaissance tours leading up to this. She was saying she actually felt physically threatened. Now a Republican congresswoman refused to go through the metal detectors that have been set up. They actually fear for their safety. So they, you know, all the military involvement, ex-military, current ex-police officers, all the different strands that led up to this, including active and passive collusion from within Defense Department, FBI, Homeland Security. I've been watching Cuccinelli looking not all that confident on Fox News, trying his best to put on a brave face in the face of what's obviously going to come out about you know, Homeland Security's lack of or active collusion. Anyway, so he's saying Snyder was saying the need to get a blue ribbon commissioned it, and he said we have to get the story right on this one, which is totally true. But what you're saying clearly is that we have to get the story right, you know, going much further back, and the importance of having, you know, at least a strong a common collective analysis from, you know, an indigenous perspective, an African-American perspective, you know, a Latino perspective, an Asian-American perspective, all these groups that haven't been in the mainstream of settler colonialism. You know, we've talked about the need for, you know, a truth and reconciliation commission along lines of what happened in South Africa, in Guatemala, actually in Maine. A lot of people don't know about, there's a state sponsored reconciliation commission with the indigenous peoples of nations of Maine, which is a very interesting one, which we actually haven't talked about on this show. But I would like to invite people to call in. We're halfway through. This is a call-in show, 503-231-8187. I also have a Facebook page at KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio. You can go there and you can like it. You can send a message. My board operator, Sonia, did say that the Ted Rawls website is actually www.rawls.com. RALL.com. He's definitely worth checking out. As I said, he in a lot of ways called what happened on Wednesday more than I'm sure there's other people out there that I'm not aware of who were explicitly pointing to the possibility of something like what happened last Wednesday. Yeah. But he definitely did. So I just want to give you another sort of point to take off on. Oregon Representative Meerman's letting in the right-wing rioters through a side or back door of the Capitol on December 21 kind of foreshadowed what happened 2 weeks later. And he, of course, you know, you can link the Proud Boys and the Patriot Prayer, with the rural occupiers of Malheur. It's all a common milieu, and the threats that are now being putting out for what could happen coming up in, you know, our state capital and around the country on this January 20. Clearly, this isn't over yet.
Yeah, a possibility for violence breaking out on January 5th, January 6th was well known for several months. I mean, I didn't actually think it would go this far. I thought this would be sort of a dry run to sort of some sort of violence and then go farther. And I know that there's another date coming up before the election as well. So there's just a lot of chatter. And of course, you know, Trump was announcing it himself in the fall. You know, I think Ezra Klein wrote something about it in Vox back in October of 2016. And also my book is available, Standoff is available at Tory House Press at their website. And it is actually, I just checked this, I don't think it's out on Kindle yet. It's just on pre-order. It'll be out in March.
Okay, I was confused by the...
Have copies available for galley copies for reviewers and stuff like that. But it's also the book's available at Amazon as well. I think that these issues, we had the FBI, give an alert out for all 50 state capitals, right? And as I told you, this movement has rural legs, right? You saw that with the state legislature, legislator here, the Republican representative. And I think that any representative or congressperson or who is in any way facilitating this should be removed from office. That's without question. And I did also put a call out for the removal of office of the three tribal citizens who are in Congress who voted to not certify Biden's election. Being of a citizen of a tribal nation and also being involved in what is basically a foreign government is complicated. It's a complicated stance to take. The Oklahoma tribes, which, have this history of fighting for the Confederacy, of being slave owners, of fighting the citizenship of freedmen, of, formerly enslaved black families who they had enslaved, are also very, very Republican, and all of the Congress people coming from these tribes, there are two Cherokee Congress people and one Chickasaw, and they are all huge Trump supporters, and they all voted not to certify the election after the deadly attack on the Capitol building, and I think that they should be removed from office, and I think that tribes should refuse to donate money to them if they do stay in office.
You think the National Congress of American Indians might discuss that issue?
No, I don't think they will. Honestly, what I think is going to happen is they're not going to do anything because they are so desperate for any sort of traction in Congress we're just in such a pitiful state. And I would also say that this rural legs also includes, as we saw, military, ex-military, active military, and also, law enforcement. The Bundys, of course, when they were here, they were appealing to the sheriffs. Right, the sheriff of Harding County, and he wouldn't. But when he met with, I watched that video so many times, contrasting the sort of interaction between the sheriff of Harney County with Ammon Bundy and the interaction with the sheriff of Morton County in North Dakota with even tribal leaders like the chairman of the tribe, right, who is in many ways the head of state of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, and he was. For attending a protest, a nonviolent protest against the pipeline, he was arrested by that sheriff and strip searched, right? When the Harney County sheriff met with Bundy, they were very respectful of each other. It was very much like a scene out of an old Western, like you're a man, I'm a man, this kind of thing. Even after the sheriff's wife had been threatened, right, and had to flee for her life, they're still treating each other this way. I think that, the Bundys were appealing to the sheriffs because they have this thing called the county supremacy. They believe in county supremacy, which is that they think that under old English common law, right, the Bundys are from England, that they believe that the sheriff is the most powerful person in the county itself, like more powerful than the U.S. government, right? And that his say is the final say on everything, that he's like some old Anglo-Saxon representative of the people. This is their whole theory. And this was promoted by Clive and Bundy's former attorney, Karen Bud Fallon, who has been suing the Bureau of Land Management for years with her with her family and with different Miss Western Lawyers organization, and these folks, these activist attorneys that have sued the BLM for racketeering, right, under RICO, they sued BLM federal employees for enforcing federal law under RICO, and now she, under Trump, she was appointed to be the deputy solicitor for the BLM. And the guy who was now head of the BLM was head of was another attorney doing this as well. So they are deeply embedded in that, and many sheriffs, a huge number of sheriffs, I think it was like 1,300 of them, former and present sheriffs, are members of this organization that supports this ideology. You know, and I think it's just over 3,000 counties in the country, right? And you have almost a third of them, you know, with sheriffs who think, because you don't need any qualifications to be sheriff, it's an elected position. And so they think that they should have county supremacy. And so when Lavoie Finicum was shot, they were traveling to the nearby county where a sheriff agreed with them here in Oregon. That's where they were going, you know, and so it's, you know, this has got legs, is what I'm saying, in the rural communities, because this is going to be a fight on many levels, almost county by county, and so, you know, or agency by agency. It's, you know, when Deb Haaland, if she becomes confirmed as the Secretary of the Interior, right, she will have, you know, she will be over the BLM, right, and she will basically have to undo a lot of the things the Trump administration did, like, you know, bringing the BLM back to D.C., doing all this stuff, taking it out of their, you know, their ability to intimidate agency officials, and she will get the backlash. I mean, what these white Cherokees and white Chickasaws in the Congress is doing is they will be endangering, by supporting these people, they are endangering the life of a brown Native woman in Congress, right, and who had, and so of the Department of the Interior, right? It's you know, this whole thing of whiteness, it's a real problem, and this is what people need to own up to, is that it's structurally a problem, and it's a poison pill of power that was introduced into this country, into what became America, very early on in the 1600s, in order to preserve the power of plantation owners in Virginia in the 1600s, right? Cause
and who and then subsequently corporations and agriculture business. I just want to let people know that we only have 20 minutes left, I did advertise that we could take some callers, and we do have Boris on the line. We only have one line open for callers, so I just want to respect them. 503-231-8187 is the number. Boris, go ahead with your comment or question.
Good morning, Paul.
Are you still there?
I am still here.
Go ahead.
I did hear the interview that you did with Ted Rall, and I was taken with the prescience of it and the fortitude with which he spoke, so much so that I mentioned it to a couple of friends because I wanted them to look into his website. I'm not at all surprised that you got at least one comment from someone who wanted to characterize it as lunacy and conspiracy and that sort of thing, because the majority of people in this country who watch mainstream news cannot tolerate anything that challenges the image of this country that we were taught in school. And so that's a pretty predictable response, I would say. And I also saw something like this coming and discussed it with people, the implications, both good and bad, of such an event. So it was very interesting to see the way that it played out. And relative to the occupation of Malheur, I want to make the point that regardless of what the way that that was characterized in the media, that had nothing to do with constitutional rights. That was all about the privatization of public land. That was the underlying message that was there, and it was a truthful message that a lot of people just didn't want to really look at. And I'll leave you with a statement from the author Herman Melville, made many years ago, and it goes like this: The truth spoken without compromise has jagged edges. And I think that's what we're looking at right now, the jagged edges of the truth of what this country really is all about.
Well, thank you with that, Boris. 503-231-8187 is your chance to get on the air. It's 8:43. We have 15 minutes left, so I encourage people to get your calls in. And Jackie, go ahead.
Yeah, before I was cut off, I was talking about how I had to disagree. I almost forgot what I was even saying. I was just so talked over by white guys. I don't know.
I'd like to get callers in because this is a call-in show, that's all.
Yeah, I would like it, but you didn't ask any questions about my book or anything. Are we just talking about this other guy's work? I don't understand what's going on here exactly. What I was getting to was that, what were you saying? You were saying that, let me see, I'm trying to think. What was I saying? You talked over me while I was trying to make a comment. What was I trying to say?
Well, you were talking about Finicum towards the end there and the counties, that that there's this delusional idea that the counties, their county supremacy movement is what you were talking about.
Yeah, it was something else. You like really talked right over me. It would have taken me a second to say it, but now I can't remember what it is anymore.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. It's difficult with the dynamics of the telephone and not being in the studio as well. I apologize for that. But I noticed that Boris had been waiting for about 10 minutes. I just wanted to make sure he got on the air.
My perspective or my book, you know, I think that would have been more relevant, to this present, I think, the Native perspective on this, the Indigenous perspective.
Indeed. So Standoff is the name of your book. It's talking about this whole history, Standing Rock, the Bundy Movement, and the American story of sacred lands. One thing that struck me, you can, if you remember what you're talking about, please go back to that, but the whole idea of the sacredness of the U.S. Capitol, the inner sanctum being, in contrast to the sacred lands of Indigenous people that are violated on a regular basis. I don't know if that's something you want to riff on.
No, not really. I think, there's a much, those are sort of pat things to say that people say that don't really lead anywhere. But I think that what I'm talking about is a structural understanding of our history that is actually useful to us to solve the problems at hand, right? And this is what the Indigenous perspective provides. I compare the Bundy's ideology going back to England, right? The name, as I mentioned before on your show, the name Bundy means bound servitude, right? In the old English, right? They were bound to their lord, And after a while, it did become serfdom under the Norman, the Norman occupation. And serfdom, if people don't know, is where the serfs were actually bound to the land. Like, you were actually part of the land, and you were inherited with the land. And you couldn't leave the land without the permission of the lord, right? And so, I think that the perspective of Native people, and I contrast the Bundys to my grandmother's family, the Delorias, and their writing, because I think that a lot of the writing that my great aunt Ella did, Ella Deloria, she wrote Speaking of Indians, and also the ethnographic novel Wutherly, among many other manuscripts, and then also my grandmother's cousin Vi Deloria Jr. in his book Custer Died for Your Sins, God is Red. These were all, I think, fundamental to creating the sort of philosophical groundwork roots for the Standing Rock movement. My grandmother's family, lived and were, her cousin was a tribal citizen of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, and so it is really fundamental to understanding, comparing both of these different things that is really important to do, and the Indigenous perspective is really crucial because, like I said before, white people lack the ability to solve this problem. White people are the problem. Whiteness is the problem here, right? And I know that's tough to hear, right? But it's true. And the voting, if you look at who's voting for Trump, it is white people. who's marching in the streets, who's doing all these things, who feels emboldened to do it. These are people who are white, who are in this system regarded as white, right? And so you really, you know, I really, you know, I got an email from the Oregon Humanities, and they're asking for a excerpt from the book. And Ben Waterhouse, you know, wrote to me. He said, I just finished reading A Galley of Standoff, and I'm reeling. You connect pieces of history I knew with aspects of the present I hadn't imagined. Clarify concepts I've struggled to express in many others I hadn't considered before. It's a bold book. Reading it felt like holding a Roman candle, as if should I not take sufficient care, it might burn me. So this is the power of a different perspective. And it's a perspective very rarely heard. You know, I think a lot of times we hear, you know, people saying the same things over and over again, you know, and that doesn't really add to you know, maybe it's a wake-up story, you know, to learn about, you know, different traumatic things that happen, but to put it in a context in which you can really change how you perceive it. And this is what, you know, the Bundys and all these folks who are marching out, they have very strong and powerful perspectives that they've honed, right, over years of thought and work. You know, like as I mentioned, the Book of Ney, which, you know, Bundy and his neighbor Kenneth Ney, they worked for decades to put this philosophical book together to shape their worldview, right? And this is something that they teach. You know, when Ammon Bundy was there and now here he was, they were teaching these things, these concepts. They had little meetings where they would, and he still is doing that up in Boise, Idaho, you know, and training militia, armed militia, to come to the support of people who are fighting the government, right? Together with the COVID restrictions, and we've seen it in our own, Capitol building, this on December 21st, where it was invaded, and so there is more of this coming, right? It's not going to go away because we want to, you know, hang on to some sort of idea of what it is to be American, right, or to be white, right? It's not going to go away, And so you really need to start looking at people have to say in their perspective, and maybe also ceding the floor to them. I think of quite a young woman who was active in the Black Lives Matter protest here in Portland. You know, she basically said early on, back in March, she was like, you know, Ted Wheeler needs to step down because he can't, it'll take too long to educate him about this issue. You know, as a white man, even, you know, allegedly progressive, you know, educated, nice white man, you know, it's going to take too long and we're all going to suffer because of it. And that's exactly what happened, you know. And so, you know, we need to, you know, Native voices and women, you know, Indigenous women's voices need to be part of this, you know, not just simply saying platitudes or, you know, did you know this happened to me? You know, we need actual structural, you know, analysis of what's going on. And that's what Standoff gives. It compares the Bundy takeovers to Standing Rock. And in that comparison, right, some really powerful sort of analysis takes place and a reshaping of your understanding of American history. And that is absolutely needed to be able to make the right decisions and to act upon them. So it's, you know, it's just this propaganda that we have and white men stumbling in the dark with each other is not going to help us. I'm sorry. It's not. It needs to stop.
Okay.
So
I did want to mention that we do have one more caller, Camilo. And before we go to him, I don't know if you want to talk about it. One thing I noticed that there was no visible counter protest in D.C. probably a good thing because it could have gotten extremely ugly and more people would have been killed. But I don't know if anyone out there knows of any active organizing for this. I guess the 17th and the 20th are the dates. So that might be interesting to talk about because I totally agree with you, and I again apologize for cutting you off there. That the getting together a common and now understanding of the real history is absolutely crucial, but also
and
confronting it.
Ceding space to non white men, white people.
Enough.
I mean, I think
well,
it's really.
Camilo is not a white man, I just want to let him ask his question or make his comment since we only have about 5-6 minutes left. Go ahead, Camilo.
A couple of points. I believe that I heard. I'm sorry. I'm just not remembering the name of your guest.
Jacqueline Keeler.
Jacqueline Keeler. Yeah, I believe that I heard her mention that there was some division among the Native tribes regarding the conflict of the Confederacy, and I want to point out that reflects the same kind of issue in the Black community. And I go back to the period of the World War and the defense industries in the city of Memphis, where the Crump organization was essentially a totally fascist government that controlled all of Shelby County and the State House in Tennessee as well. A. Philip Randolph tried to speak there, and Crump had most of the ministers, Black ministers, in his pocket, and that was the beginning of a big struggle. And I point this out because, in speaking terms of the issue of fascism today, the discussion about fascism in American government goes back to that period of World War when A. Philip Randolph was speaking about the importance of victory on two fronts over fascism here in the United States as well as against in Europe. And I want to just echo the idea about the historical analysis, and it clearly begins with the founding, but I think that is really reiterated critically during the Reconstruction, and I think that what we witnessed really is playing out of Reconstruction that really never has been resolved. And I think the point that Jacqueline is making about this being such a deep rent is part of the reason that we're not going to see any easy resolution to this, because that issue of white supremacy has never been dealt with. What's really interesting about doing this kind of historical research is to see where during the 40s and probably into the 50s and 60s too in the South, white supremacy was taken for granted and spoken about openly. It's really only since the Brown decision that it's become a sub rosa subject.
Well, we're just about out of time. I'd like to let Jack give.
And actually, I remember what it was I was being talked over earlier about. And the issue is, there's many points I'd like to address, but of course, we must remember that here in the North, Portland itself was a sundown town in the 1950s. So it was a town where I was raised, Richland, Washington. And the issue of the corporate issue is what I wanted to address, which is that one of the things I bring out in Standoff is the fact that, and I've mentioned this before on the show, that the original colonies, many of them had their beginnings as corporate entities. Of course, we all know about the Virginia company that started Virginia. And of course, also owned the land where the Mayflower landed in Plymouth, had the charter from the British from the English Queen. And so this is what I bring out, is that I compare indigenous people to colonists, and to me, the colonist always has been a corporate creature, right? Their origin story is a corporate story from the very beginning, from these very early joint stock companies, which were created to fund colonialism and exploration. The crown couldn't afford to do it itself, so they turned to the subjects to create these, to pool money together to fund it. And so, our states like Virginia and Massachusetts began as corporations, right? That's their actual origin story, and I think that people forget that this has been a long-term corporate endeavor, and so the blending of corporation and military things and taking of land and even of taking of people's lives through enslaving people I think is something that we need to really understand, that there's hand in hand the entire time. There's never been a point it has not been. And so so that's really what I wanted to talk about as well before I was kind of stopped from talking.
Fair enough. Well, we only have a minute or two left. So the one thing I really like to hear you talk about at some point was the, you know, we talk about, like Camilo was talking about the Reconstruction, and you try to pull together, you know, these twin histories of the theft of an enforced enslavement of African Americans and the theft, expropriation, and genocide of Indigenous Americans. But a lot of time they seem to be kind of talked about separately. I don't know, is that something that resonates with you?
I in my intro to the book, I do make it clear that my book, because of its nature, does not sufficiently address the issue of slavery, which is really a crucial part. And I do mention, though, you know, the creation of the concept of race, which really occurred in Virginia, right? And because of the collaboration between that was occurring between indentured servants from mostly the British Isles and from folks who had been stolen from the west coast of Africa and brought here, and they were beginning to work together, and so the plantation owners had to stop that, and this is where the creation of race emerges. And I would recommend, of course, I love Michelle Alexander, her book, you know, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration, The Age of Colorblindness, is really a fundamental book to go through a lot of this history and understand it. And it definitely would be, you know, I think that it needs to be addressed as well. And I don't pretend that my book addresses that adequately.
Well, I didn't mean to make it a criticism. I haven't actually read your book. I'd like to get a copy of it, but we are totally out of time.
I mean, it's like, well, how can it? You know, but I mean, there are excellent Black academics and scholars and writers who have addressed it in really incredible ways. I mean, rich.
Well, we are at the end of the hour. Thank you, Jackie, as always. Thank you for listening. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Bye, everybody.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
Tune into KBOO for Bridge Over Troubled Water, a tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.